So hopefully nobody has to leave because we do just have a quorum. I haven't seen anybody put up for appointment yet. Have you heard of anything?
Not yet.
Okay. Mm-hmm. All right. Well, we'll keep asking the mayor's office about that. Oh, yay, two more. Excellent.
I heard about that.
Yeah. I did a little bit, yep. 4, 5, 6, 7. Okay.
That's kind of fishy anyway.
Because I remember David told me had said before he was interested.
I suggested
that you
talk to her.
So
I'll call her. I'll call her.
Meeting.
Okay. All right, I'll call her.
Supposed to be. Do you have any questions?
With the state.
With the state?
I'll do that. Thank you. Yeah. Okay, let's call a meeting to order.
And risk management.
We do have a lot on the agenda this evening, so I'll just remind everybody and any presenters that the commissioners have committed to reading the material ahead of time. So just maybe asking for questions and keeping your presentations brief, and if you could, would be very helpful because we do have a lot of ground to cover this evening. Did everybody have an opportunity to look at the minutes?
Move approval.
Second.
There's a motion and a second. Any discussion? All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Do we have any public comment on topics not on this agenda? Okay. Any disclosures and recusals? We have had those in the past, so I have to make sure I'm looking all around the room. Okay, staff reports. Lieutenant Fiore, if you'd join us at the table, please. And maybe just introduce yourself for those who may not know you.
Tony Fiore. I've been with the police department for a little over 21 years now. And new to the assignment as a traffic lieutenant, but have held a variety of positions within the department and excited about working not only in traffic but also emergency management as part of my assignment as well. So wear two hats, but certainly this is gets my full attention and looking forward to working with this group. As a side note, I actually, early on in my career, I was on our, we had an evening test team, traffic team for a while, and I was part of that initial inaugural unit. So traffic is close to my heart, and I enjoyed my time on that unit and glad to get back to that group.
And why don't you talk just a little bit about your goals with regard to...
Sure. Really learning the position and even coming into the position, I was encouraged by the work that Lieutenant Knight had done and Lieutenant Yukovich had done of really trying to realign the efforts of our traffic team, but also just our routine patrol efforts at traffic enforcement. A lot of the citations that you see are traffic enforcement. Nowadays, due to staffing and calls for service volume, is a lot of that's reflected from crash investigations. So most crash investigations result in some type of citation, but proactive enforcement can be few and far between from your average patrol officer, which is just the unfortunate realities of how busy the city's gotten. We try to take the opportunities. My goal is really to take the opportunities that they do get and focus those towards hazardous moving violations, primarily in our identified crash, high crash areas or high volume areas. And I've been working a lot with traffic engineering to look at the data, look at not only a lot of crashes, but which areas are causing injuries or significant injuries or fatalities. So trying to provide opportunities for officers who do want to take opportunities to do proactive enforcement and get those lined up with our goals as a department, which is really focusing on the crash areas. That being said, I oversee our test team, our crash investigators. We have two full-time crash investigators that investigate our significant or fatal crashes. They're experts in their OWI enforcement, drug recognition, so they provide a lot of guidance for officers making OWIRS and negotiating them through that process on some of the more complicated cases. And then I also manage all of our traffic-related grants. So we have grants for alcohol or OWI enforcement, speed enforcement, seatbelts, and pedestrian and bike safety. So manage all those and try to get those efforts, again, aligned with the departmental goals and certainly the city's goals as far as addressing the crashes and the significant injury crash areas. So.
Okay.
The presentation is really modeled off of what Lieutenant Yukovich presented last time. I heard positive feedback from that, so I just modeled my initial graphs and information, added a little bit of new information and changed how a little bit of the information was displayed. But certainly open to input if there's more depth wanted on some area or we don't need a certain piece of information or whatever, really can take the time to make this presentation, this time with you all, what you want it to be and what information you're looking from the department. So if I cover anything and you have questions or want more about this next time, please let me know and we'll effort to make sure that you get that information. So the goals that were discussed within our management team and are being expressed to the entire department are really fall into four areas. We're looking at our top crash intersections, both within from our own internal data as far as where our recent crash data points us. We have our own crash data, and certainly traffic engineering has theirs. The state has a set of data that we can work off of, but really what we go off of is historical knowledge of high crash areas, which is mainly from traffic engineering, and then we look at recent crashes. And in the city, one map tends to look like a map from a year ago. Those crash areas don't change a lot unless there's significant changes to the roadways. The large roundabouts and things like that might present new challenges for us, but in general, they don't change a whole lot. So we focus on our crash intersections. Certainly, school zone enforcement continues to be an effort for us. Our high volume or hazardous corridors, so your East Washington Avenue, Stoughton Road, Mineral Point Road, where speeds tend to increase, they're large corridors, so they tend to see a lot of crashes as well. So that's another focus area for us, as well as traffic complaints. And those are our four main focus areas. That's not to say officers can't do proactive enforcement outside of those areas, but again, we try to take the efforts that they do have time to do and focus it into one of these goal areas. Might be a little hard to see, but basically looking at crash data from us from quarter three on the left, which is what was presented to you last time, and looking at quarter four now, which is on the right. And so we're looking at October, November, and December of 2019. And some of the dots have moved as far as our higher crash areas, but generally they're pretty much along the same corridors or where we would expect within a plus or minus area for them to appear. I wouldn't attribute any of the moves to anything significant that our efforts or anything else that we've done. It's just the way that the seasons change traffic patterns or crashes come in. So they generally fall within the downtown area, East Washington and Stoughton Road corridors, and then general Mineral Point and Gammon areas is where we see our highest crash, and the John Nolan Drive area. Our overall speeding citations fall generally within those high crash zones, but the overlay kind of just shows you where our traffic, where our speeding efforts or speed enforcement efforts generally take place. And we move those around, but again, trying to line those up, getting folks to slow down, particularly in those known high crash zones, is really what our goal is.
Awesome.
Yes, sir.
So on that map, what generally is it that the blue and the red are the same kind of behavior, but some for some reason get a warning, others don't, or does it also differentiate on the type of behavior?
Generally, warnings are a product of either the speed is not significant, but over the posted speed limit, and they're doing an activity, and so a warning is generated out of that, or a speed-related warning might come out of it in terms of if a vehicle stopped for speeding and they're not wearing their seatbelt, or they've got a issue with their driver's license, and officers choosing to address one of the issues and providing a warning for maybe the speed violation.
I'm looking at that red smudge that I'm assuming is John Nolan.
Correct.
That probably a short-term aggressive, I hate the word aggressive, but aggressive patrolling and sort of just giving a bunch of warnings all in a short period of time?
And John Nolan Drive, that section, pretty much it's primarily outbound traffic, and I can't speak to why we might have seen more warnings in a particular effort. I think it's just a combination of doing a lot of traffic enforcement in that area.
Okay.
We ran quite a few grants in that area, so officers come in and write a variety of either citations or warnings. So nothing particularly that we've been doing on purpose.
I mean, because I don't see a bunch of crashes or other things there.
Right.
So it was just a choice of where to enforce.
Correct. And it's for our grants, it's a combination of how can we maximize that time and still focus on corridors where we know if we are doing speed enforcement in a particular area that might not be directly on top of where that crash happens, but adjacent to one of those corridor efforts, that if we know we can do proactive enforcement on those areas, knowing that we're addressing the corridor by sending the signal and people are driving on that corridor and addressing behavior, but also knowing that people are driving by and seeing five or six squad cars with vehicles pulled over and it sends a message.
So. Thanks.
The right-of-way for other vehicles, again, this is primarily a traffic crash citation that gets written around a lot. So when officers are investigating if somebody failed to yield the right-of-way in some fashion, typically that's when these citations are generated. Certainly a proactive enforcement opportunity, but generally these citations come out of crashes. Same thing with vehicles wrong way. There's only so many one-way streets. Most of those fall downtown, so that's why you see that concentration downtown. Again, right-of-way to ped or bikes, just the concentration of where we see that down in the campus area and downtown Isthmus areas where we see most of our pedestrian and bike traffic, and that's where you see a lot of those citations come out of. Not a lot of tickets in that area, primarily because of the colder months, but I would expect those numbers to go up significantly as we get to the warmer months, and particularly when we start doing our pedestrian and bicycle safety grants. You'll see those numbers go up. OWIs, I did add that. Wasn't something that was included last time, but I thought it was a good piece of information for this group to consider is our OWI enforcement efforts. Those, you can see, are spread throughout the city. Nobody's in particular, but certainly downtown with the entertainment district, more cops downtown to do that type of enforcement or on-site enforcement, and then it kind of gets spread throughout the city from there on. So that's both proactive as well as crash investigations. OWI enforcement with this volume is primarily proactive. So we do get it out of crashes where there's a drunk driving investigation, but I thought this was an important piece of information to add just so you know the amount of OWI enforcement we are doing out there. The speed enforcement efforts, just representing this on a pie chart by the areas that we tend to focus on, really our 35-mile-per-hour zones, your John Nolan Drives and other larger roadways but still within the city get a lot of attention, as well as our 55-mile-per-hour zones. So your Highway 30, your Beltline enforcement. So that's where we see most of our tickets come out of. 25, we don't tend to do a lot of traffic initiatives in residential areas where you see most of the 25-mile-per-hour zones, so that's why you see the citation numbers lower than our 35s. 35-mile-per-hour roadways are typically set up a little bit better for us to do team activities where we can really generate a lot of stops in a short amount of time. Traffic complaints. I just represented this just a little bit different. I don't know if you got this information last time. I just wanted to show that actually this wasn't by quarter. This was by year. I'm sorry. This was all of 2019. Somewhere just over 900 total traffic complaints that we brought into just the police department. And one of the discussions we've had is that the pedestrian bike person also receives complaints. Traffic engineering receives complaints. And working towards a way to bring all those complaints in through one set of data so traffic engineering knows where we're getting complaints about driving behavior or speeds. And our complaints range from specific driving behavior of an individual driver to just hazardous road conditions. People are always speeding by my residence and things like that. So it's pretty spread out throughout the city. But those are something we push those out to the individual traffic officers and give them opportunities to address those specific complaints if they can. Crossing guards, I just wanted to talk real briefly about our crossing guard zones. I represented it by the total number of warnings and violations by district, and then I broke that down. I thought it was a little bit interesting the way the numbers were coming out that are in Central District, we service two schools, which is basically one big school in the O'Keefe. I'm trying to think of the elementary schools, Marquette. That area is really the only place we have a crossing guard downtown. We generate a lot of citations and warnings out of those school crossings. And we do out of the other districts, but certainly not to the volume that Central generates that. And part of that might be attributed to a specific, a diligent crossing guard that does a good job of documenting and following through with the hazardous driving. But they're also crossing Williamson Street during high volume morning commute. So I think that's real. I'm concerned about that number as far as the number of close calls that they're experiencing at that intersection. So that's something we're going to take a look at as well. Again, our top, just in the we had 131 warnings and citations for failure to stop for crossing guards. So that's a big number, and excessive speed through the school zone was second with 76. And then our grant enforcement, I just wanted to touch real briefly about that in case you had any questions. The black dots represent where our grant deployment locations were, and typically when we operate the grants, we do that with one person from our traffic team that coordinates the grant efforts, and they tend to focus on one specific geographical area if they can. And again, those are based off of working with Dane County Sheriff's Office and the two grants we're operating right now. We do take a task force approach with them, and that they work the same corridor but out in their jurisdiction. So we're a little limited in the areas that we can work, but generally their problem areas line up pretty closely with our problem areas. So we tend to spread those activities throughout the city and try to really focus on those areas that the crash data points us towards.
Okay.
Yeah.
I have a favor to ask, or maybe a suggestion. If we could convince Mick Rush to give us 20 back of the buses advertisements, mm-hmm. could you come back the next time and tell us what three messages you would put on as far as educating drivers in Madison?
Yeah, certainly. I think that enforcement without education, I think, you know, people understanding why we're out there and why we're doing what we're doing, I think goes a long way. And messaging is something we've certainly been working on and will continue to do so. So I'll definitely work on that and try to come back with some ideas of what kind of you know, off the top of my head, I can think of slowing down, you know, something to do with distracted driving or texting while driving, and probably OWI, you know, drinking and driving. So
yeah. No, it'd be just interesting what if you just talked among your officers.
I certainly will.
Because in my opinion, I'm an old guy. You know, I took my last road test years ago or something like that.
Sure.
And, you know, so how you get educated is just episodically. You read something in the newspaper that they passed a new law about what does that white line mean and all those kind of things.
Right.
And I think I've always been interested in how we can use the buses as a way, it's where the people are driving, to say, here's how to be a better driver.
Right. And I know we've done those efforts with on the Beltline and with the scrolling billboards and things like that. So those efforts have certainly grabbed attention. And I think the slogans help, the click it or ticket, and those initiatives as they roll out throughout the year, I think getting that message out more and more certainly helps. And I'm happy to come back with some ideas.
Great idea. A few years ago, the City of Madison collaborated with Wisconsin DOT. We did exactly that. We put messages on the buses. We actually did quite a few. Those messages were pedestrian oriented. So mostly, you know, yell to pedestrians in crosswalk, those type of messaging. But I guess the messaging can be broader.
Thanks.
Grant?
Thanks. Welcome. Thanks for your presentation.
Thank you.
One thing I just wanted to bring up is traffic engineering and the transportation department are, and the transportation policy and planning board are working around preparing for Vision Zero implementation. So I'm sure you've kind of got some of that information already, and I think it'll be a great opportunity to talk more about how we, you know, work together. So I think we're well prepared for that. One of the kind of the big theme of that is focusing on injury and fatality prevention as opposed to crash prevention.
Sure.
So one thing that came to mind with this presentation is, and I think Yang and Traffic Engineering has some good data, but I like sort of looking at the enforcement activity overlaid on, in this case, it's the crash data.
Right.
I'm wondering what it would look like overlaid instead on that sort of injury, mostly injury mapping. So that might be something to see if we could get a version of that.
Right. And we discussed that this week, as a matter of fact, talking about looking at bringing both your in Madison, we have a little bit of a luxury in that we don't have a huge N, if you will, of fatal crashes. So looking at that over time. But really, I think our significant injury crashes will give us a much better set of data to look at the benefits of vehicle technology, of improved, T&E, as far as how we design our roadways. Having a level one trauma in three hospitals within 5 to 10 minutes, make a lot of those what could potentially be fatal crashes into significant injury. So I think that significant injury data would really help guide our efforts. And I'm excited about bringing a lot of our efforts, and throughout the city we've seen it, but certainly the police department's efforts on traffic safety and bringing those under an umbrella, so like Vision Zero, so we can continue to work with partners throughout the city, certainly throughout the county. We're working with Shorewood and UW in the spring to work on some other grants, so we're excited about that. We really are, and I think it'll point to a lot of the efforts that are already ongoing throughout the city and re-energizing and focusing those efforts.
Great. Yeah, so maybe at some point incorporating that into these presentations.
Yeah, absolutely.
Shift that focus a little bit towards
My guess is we'll have that data flushed out better, and I'll be able to represent that here probably by the next meeting. My guess we have that data weaned out a little bit. And
great.
T&E's got a little bit better data for that than we do, but we'll work on it.
A couple other thoughts. The kind of in that same vein, on their speed enforcement activity by zone, the pie chart you had, I don't know if you're familiar with, but there's some, you know, good data around speed of impact, and this is particularly around, you know, pedestrian or bicycle, which are, you know, some of the more common injury crashes. and the percentage of fatality by speed. So it's really, you know, like 20 miles an hour, it's not so bad. 30 is pretty bad, and then 40, it's, you know, you're probably not going to make it.
Right.
And so it sort of stuck out for me that most of our enforcement activity is on 35 and above. So we're sort of in that category where, you know, we're already sort of targeting an area where we're past that threshold. And I wonder if thinking about shifting a little bit more towards the 25 and 30 mile an hour zones where we might be able to have more of a difference, you know, if we can keep folks at the 25 or 30 rather than going 35 in those zones,
right.
Might have a bigger impact. Obviously acknowledging the challenges of enforcement that it, like you said, it's sort of, it's more productive and easier to do it on the bigger roads, but just maybe thinking about doing some more of the slower kind of streets, and especially those where, again, you know, traffic engineering has a list of where they're getting complaints from people, and they know that here's a 25 where our average speed, or there's you know, 35. Thinking about targeting some of those might be something to consider. A question on the ped bike enforcement activity. What's the nature of that grant, and what is the, like, for the citations that you showed up there, what's kind of the focus of that enforcement?
We can do those in a number of different ways. Typically, we've done everything from what they call a duck operation, where we have an officer actually through a very pretty stringent set of criteria as far as timing and giving motorists a fair opportunity to yield to that pedestrian. So we've actually done where we'll have somebody crossing the intersection and do proactive enforcement that way. We can do on-site enforcement. We can do the effort is towards that failure to yield. The failure to yield the right of way. A lot of education about that. I think Madison has some catching up to do based on other information from other communities around the country as far as doing a better job at getting the message out there that who's responsible for what at any given time and that. So we're really looking, we do a lot of pedestrian enforcement downtown. So that those grants are focused towards and I had to qualify this a couple times in other conversations. We're not out there we're not citing pedestrians and bicyclists. That's not the efforts that we're making at all. It's really about motorist responsibility in those areas. And we look at those are usually done downtown just because of the higher concentration.
Like crosswalk kind of.
Right, but I certainly, when just you mentioning that, thinking about opportunities even on John Nolan Drive where it's a 35-mile-per-hour zone and bikes and pedestrians are coming into pretty close contact with the road, you know, having to cross a wide roadway and things like that. So we'll probably, I think in May, we'll start rolling those efforts out. Maybe as soon as April, we'll start those efforts. So hopefully I'll be able to report back a little bit about how we're deploying those grants and kind of what activities we're doing to focus our attention on that pedestrian bike safety issues.
Great, thank you. One element of that we started, that's actually a former version of this body, started a conversation with Lieutenant Knight before he left, was around red light enforcement and, you know, sort of the beginning of the red light, right? People
right.
trying to fly through, and I've heard sort of anecdotally from a lot of people in the community that seems like it's a growing issue. I know we can't do red light cameras here. I don't know if that would fit in that grant program or if it would be a different area, but I think it'd be really interesting to at least maybe try and pull together kind of try that once.
Right.
And, you know, there's a few intersections that probably be pretty easy to do that on. I think some kind of campaign around that would be really helpful to think about on the ped bike safety.
No, I appreciate that, and I've agreed. And one of the things that the history of it is that we did, when we got the grants initially, doing more of those efforts that we knew would result in fewer citations but more focused effort. And some of those were less successful than others in that we weren't producing enough to represent to the state that we're making good use of that grant money. So a lot of our efforts went towards producing enough that the state was happy with our production level and focusing on the areas as best we could, that any enforcement in a given area will draw attention to these issues, whether they be speed or red lights. But I agree 100% that If you have a problem with left turn crashes at major intersections, it's because people are running yellow lights or red lights, and people are anticipating being able to sneak through or get through that intersection before the cross traffic starts. And I think the best way to do that is to address those actual violations because they're happening, and just being willing to work with our partners and say, you'll see fewer tickets, and we have to be willing to accept fewer tickets. It's much easier to run a speed wave and have five or six cars doing speed waves than it is to do a red light, where we might get 15 to 20 tickets in a couple hours doing a speed wave. We might end up with 4 to 6 tickets doing a red light enforcement. And I think the 4 to 6 tickets might be our better choice for that type of enforcement effort. So I agree. We're definitely thinking along the same lines, and that's going to be part of my effort this year of reminding folks too that there's a yellow signal violation. There's not just a red signal violation. We can write those tickets too. So
thank you. I think that would be great. If you want to go to Dunning Street and Atwood, you could probably get one every cycle. So I'm sure you could probably still get your 20 per hour doing it that way. Two other quick points. One is around speed boards. So I just did a ride along this week in the East District, and heard that the speed board hadn't been deployed much sort of recently. I think those are more at the kind of district level, right? Not sort of part of your team's sort
Correct.
Of responsibility. Right. It just sort of stuck out with me as, you know, I've got all these lists of residents complaining to me about different areas, and there might be an opportunity there to just basically should probably have those deployed most all the time. Mm-hmm. And again, I think traffic engineering probably has a good list of areas with speeding, and even if we're just, you know, not even necessarily waiting for a new complaint, but just sort of, if they're not needed anywhere else, just keep them out there rotating through some of the most kind of problematic areas. I think it'd be a good use of them, you know, rather than having them just sit off somewhere.
No, that's a great suggestion. I think we sat in on a webinar earlier this week, and they said those speed boards are actually very good at providing immediate feedback to drivers and reminding them that there is a speed limit and they're over it, and that does calm overall speed. So that's a great suggestion.
And my last point is actually probably for Ying, so that you brought up the Williamson-Thornton crossing and the crossing guard there. I know I've heard a lot about that one as well. Just sort of a plug to consider having that be part of the Shanks Corner study. I know there was some talk or consideration about possibly putting a light there at some point. So just, I think it's within or right on the edge of the study limits there. So maybe that crossing, that Thornton and Willie crossing, could be included in that study.
That makes a lot of sense. Yeah, I believe that's a plan.
Thank you.
Yeah, and kind of get back to the speed board trailers. Traffic engineering purchased a couple last year, and we have been using them a lot, deploying them to different streets. So we so far covered a lot of streets. As of right now, it's on Segal Road near the Van Heys and Hamilton schools. But we definitely will moving them around.
Other comments, Bill?
Lieutenant, we look forward to spring, which means street construction.
Sure.
And I think Gammon is going to go into construction this year. I foresee challenges, especially as that construction starts, to get the drivers for speed enforcement through that work zone.
Sure.
It's going to be a challenge just to get all that congestion accommodated. So the earlier when it to work with engineering and when that project starts, I think would be worthwhile to, especially the first week or two that project gets started, because it's going to be a challenge to get drivers to understand it's not business as usual during that construction this year.
Yeah,
it's going to be a major project.
And our traffic team has done proactive enforcement efforts for speeding and distracted driving through construction zones. So if they're on their cell phone, that's a primary stop violation. So we have done those efforts. So we'll look for Gammon in the spring when they break ground.
Other comments or questions? We need a motion to accept the report.
So moved.
Second.
There's a motion and a second. Further discussion? All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carried. Thank you very much.
Very much.
Great discussion. Okay, next, we have the item F1, authorizing the issuance of a request for proposals for a Metro Transit Network Structure Study. Mike?
Thank you. So you have in your packet a summary of the project. The first page is project summary, and then the second is the draft scope of work, and this basically gets dropped into the city's boilerplate RFP request for proposals to do the network study. There's about $500,000 budgeted for this study. The basic goal is we have BRT coming online in 2024, and so we need to restructure the local service to fit in with BRT, to have BRT and local service work together, and then also looking at the just in general, it's an opportunity to look at the system as a whole and see if we want to do things differently, redo how we do the routes and the service. So it's a comprehensive look at the system. So our schedule is we would like to go out, put the RFP out on the street in like early March. It goes to council at the end of February. It goes back to the TPPB later this month, and then as soon as council authorizes it, we could put it out there. Starting on page two is just kind of a summary of the work items for the study. So project management and administration is pretty basic project management stuff. And then community engagement, the consultants shall develop and perform community engagement. And so we're trying to educate policy makers and gather feedback, engage the community and transit riders to obtain feedback and provide information on the alternatives, provide information and framework to make a decision. Number three, data assemblage and analysis. And then I also want to mention, too, we took this to the policy board earlier in the month, and they gave us some feedback. And so those changes are highlighted in blue bold if you have color and underlined, or just bold and underlined if you don't have color. So data assemblage and analysis, so basically they're going to look at our system and see how it's performing, where are the gaps. A lot of times what they'll do is they'll look at kind of a mobility. So, for example, you know, if you're at a certain point, how far can you get in a half an hour? Frequency and travel times and transfers all plays into that. Developing alternatives, we have them developing three transit network alternatives, and then we're having them budgeted for an optional fourth. And then alternatives evaluation, so then they evaluate the alternatives based on performance, ridership. A lot of these look at kind of the trade-off between coverage and ridership. So, for example, you can concentrate a lot of your service on the core routes as they go through town and the major corridors, East Wash, Park Street, University Avenue, and improve the frequency where you can gain ridership with your service. Or, you know, the other extreme of that is you spread everything thin and you provide a very coverage intensive system where everybody has a bus, but it's once an hour and things like that. So that's how they'll be evaluating the alternatives, and then finally documentation, including an implementation framework that could be. So a lot of these changes are intended to be in place in 2024 with BRT opening. We could have some of them go in earlier. So, for example, 2022 is sort of the earliest that if there are some changes that are not related to BRT that seem like they could be put in sooner.
I would just like to point out that version one of the resolution was attached in Legistar, but also version two, which has some updates that were recommended by the policy board. So I don't know if Grant or Chris, if you want to comment on that.
I think the piece that stands out in my mind is you'll notice in the the draft goals, there were some added, and that was mainly a response to, I think, a general concern that some of the goals that were originally in here were too specific and about, like, we want the system to do this, like, run more frequently, right, versus higher level goals like the first one, reducing VMT and driving load share.
Mm-hmm. And in the resolution itself, there was language added that the RFP would be approved by the Transportation Policy and Planning Board, and a member of the Policy Board would serve on the selection committee for the consultant, and also that the Department of Transportation would forward the recommendation for a consultant to the Policy Board for approval. So I just want to make sure people are aware there's a version one and a version two of the resolution before we take action in terms of which particular version we would be looking at and thinking about. So other comments? Harold and then Bill?
Yeah, I think a lot of my comments are about those changes. So I watched a video recording of the TPBB meeting where there, I think, was a very good discussion about a lot of the specificity versus general comments. And I think one of the things that was talked about was that not having too many goals at the outset versus giving the consultants the freedom to develop the goals as part of the process. And so seeing the edits to the goals, I think that's actually maybe even almost more prescriptive. Like, if you read the draft goals, this looks like the goal is to have more ridership. I mean, if you want to improve transit's mode share, then that's a ridership goal. If you want to simplify service by reducing the number of overlapping routes, that's a ridership goal. And I'm not saying that's necessarily a bad thing, but I think all of these goals lean toward ridership versus coverage, whereas elsewhere, well, that's part of what the study is supposed to evaluate and provide options. So that's just an observation. One question about the community engagement part. I think there was also some discussion at TPPB about how can you get meaningful community engagement, how can you make sure that underrepresented populations are part of the community engagement. I was wondering, the way the RFP is written right now, would that allow the consultants to, I don't know, contract with local organizations to do the community engagement process?
Yeah.
Because I think often that is kind of a necessary way to get meaningful engagement, to work with local people.
Yeah, and they probably all will.
Okay.
That's pretty common.
Wonderful. And then in section four about developing alternatives, I think there was some discussion about the framing of the system alternative should be revenue neutral versus operating expense neutral.
Yes, and I'm sorry, that was one of the changes that the policy board had asked for and I had neglected. It's just a typo. On my part, the goal is not revenue. It's really just to keep the operating costs generally the same, with an understanding that there will be a minor increase compared to the budget as a whole. There will be a increase to operate BRT in some form, probably an increase of operating budget for BRT, and then some corresponding reduction in local service, but overall an overall increase. And the correct word there is operating budget.
Okay.
Not revenue. Sorry about that.
Yeah. And then I think there was also some discussion about potentially, maybe as an optional component, have like some sort of scenario. Well, what if we had another $1 million? Like, what would that allow? And maybe not having that as a necessary component of the project, but
that could
nice have it.
That could be our fourth optional alternative. That is one of the main things that the consultants will likely ask. A lot of times when communities do this, it's like, well, we're trying to pass a tax or get more money or something, and so we're showing how we would, what we would do with that. So, you know, you can have, these are more, that's one of the reasons we put in a separate alternative if that comes up.
So BRT will be a substantial operating in cost increase. Those sort of the thinking there.
Thank you.
Bill?
I guess, Mike, the technical documentation, not so much to the for the public's benefit, but for the Metro staff's benefit of how these different software programs or packages that they're going to use, and whether it's multiple or just one big package or something, I think would be useful as far as knowledge about that and how it works, and whether that would be a technical paper that would be required for them to produce to the city so that they could use that in follow-up in following years after ERT gets started or after these changes get started, so that if the city decides to, you know, or looks at it, you know, to use, could replicate it, if you will, without having to go back to the same consultant. So knowing what that software is and how they're how it works, and maybe, you know, what decisions would the city like to replicate, if you will, at some future time after the study is completed, I think would be useful to.
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, we'll definitely know what they did and what software they used, and we can have that discussion with them, and that could be part of the documentation.
But as a document that they would, you know, is a deliverable.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
So you're looking to, are you asking that they add like routing, scheduling, software evaluation,
right,
as part,
right,
of this?
I think it would be useful. But
comments on that from the group? And where would that get added in, would you think, Mike?
That would be, I mean, it would probably be another scope item. If I could append that, that is, it's a little bit of a different. We'd want to. It doesn't exactly fit into the scope of what we envisioned. We will definitely know what they use to evaluate it. If we have them. What we could do is we could go a little way and just have them send us a memo saying, this is like maybe, for example, here's a memo saying how you could use software in the future to re-evaluate your system every 5 or 10 years or something. That would be a pretty low effort thing. If we went deeper in where we actually have them contacting providers and going through costs and stuff, that might be a little bit more.
No, but I think, you know, they're obviously going to use some software.
Yeah.
And we should know what that is.
Oh, we will. Yeah.
Yeah. And I would think they would include that in their proposal.
Right. Yeah. And I'm just suggesting maybe that's something that goes into the documentation of what they used and something maybe not a separate deliverable, but you can. Whatever we have to, we'll do.
Because they're talking about system alternatives under documentation there. So perhaps it would be covered there. Is that what you're suggesting, Mike?
Yeah, perhaps, you know, adding a deliverable in number 6. I don't think that would be too.
Just a memo.
Yeah.
Ken?
Mike, I'm assuming that the successful bidder on this has done this before.
I hope so.
Yeah. I'm wondering, I don't want to interfere with the awarding of the bid, but after the bid is awarded, could you find if they would have a couple of reports that they've recently done for others? And I don't want you to send all of them, but maybe put it at the table so that we could take a look at it and just sort of say, whet our appetite a little bit to say, oh, this is what ours will sort of look like. It's not.
Yeah. In fact, I've downloaded a few. They're out there.
I think that would be helpful for me to start gearing up.
Sure. Is that something that could be sent to the through the channels?
Patrick. Yeah.
Yeah, we can send that out.
Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Good suggestion. Other Carl?
One more question, which maybe relates to this. In terms of how much money we have to do this study, and how that compares to other transit systems who have done similar efforts. I'm kind of curious, like, how that compares, and, like, to make sure that we're not asking for too much or for little given the amount of money that we have to do the study.
I think it's an appropriate amount. It's definitely enough. Like Houston, for example, I just contacted somebody who had talked to them, and they said that they ran out of money and didn't budget enough, but that's a very much bigger city. And then we talked to a couple of smaller communities. They budgeted a little bit less, but probably relatively proportional to the size of the transit system. I think it's about appropriate.
Yeah, because, I mean, I think that's the worst-case scenario where, like, yeah, your scope is too big and then you run out of money and then you end up with a half-baked product rather than refining your scope beforehand, but then getting a good quality product.
Yeah.
Other comments? Is there a motion?
Make a motion for approval.
Version two. With the changes that Mike talked about? Yep. Okay. So there's a motion.
Second.
And a second. To approve version two with those minor changes that, minor corrections basically, that, and a couple additions that we discussed to the, not to the resolution itself, but to the, excuse me, microphone there, to the scope of work. Further discussion. All those in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Any abstentions? Motion carried. Thanks, Mike. Next, we're going to talk about tires. Who's here to talk about tires?
Move approval. This is a pretty routine
thing.
This is the only way we can run our buses.
This is true. Pretty straightforward.
I'll second that.
There's a motion and a second. I just have one question. Is it $250,000 or is it $264,000?
Got me. I don't know.
In the be it resolved, it's $250,000, but the operating budget up above it says includes $264,000. So I just want to make sure we're approving what you need.
I'd go with the higher number.
Do I see what I'm talking about up at the top? It's budgeted at $264,000.
Move approval of the $264,000.
Okay. I just want to make sure that we have, because we need the tires, as Ken pointed out. So is everybody comfortable who made the motion that we included at $264,000? Further discussion? All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried. Okay. Thank you.
And the fancy white wall tires, that's what added that $14,000.
Okay, traffic signal priority list. Who's going to be doing this, Yang? Oh, Jerry? Jerry and Brian? Okay.
Hi, everyone. I'm Jerry Shipper with City Madison Traffic Engineering Department.
And Brian Smith with City Traffic Engineering.
So in December, we were here looking at the list of requests for traffic signal studies. We whittled that down to 8 intersections to do further studies, and this we're here to approve the list and our recommendations. So I'll just go through the 8 and list the intersection and our recommendation. If you have any questions, they can follow. So starting at Proudfit in Maine, we are recommending maintaining the current stop sign control, but adding this intersection to our 2020 pedestrian and bike project list with looking at adding a rectangular rapid flashing beacon and possibly some geometric changes to the median. The second one is Packers Avenue in Aberg. We're recommending installing a traffic signal primarily due to the delay of northbound right-turning vehicles, which is a little rare, but has happened in the past, but that queue in the PM peak would back up onto Packers Avenue. So that met the peak hour warrant. Collins Court, East Broadway, Service Road and East Broadway. Also the Dutch Mill Park and Ride and there's a gas station that intersection. We're recommending maintaining the current stop sign control and looking at some efforts to direct drivers who are trying to make a left to get onto like the Beltline to use it's East Broadway, but further to the east, where it kind of makes a slight curve to go north, and there's a T intersection there. There's actually, that's how the buses turn around and head back on their route. So we're going to look at ways to direct people to use that intersection to turn left. Heartland Trail, Old Sauk Road, we're recommending installing a traffic signal and doing some pavement marking changes to that approach. You add a right turn lane. Currently it's just one lane on the approach, but it's a very wide lane, so we would look at adding a left turn and a right turn lane with keeping the on-street bike lane. I skipped number four. Thanks, Brian. Skip four, High Crossing and Cross Hill. We are recommending keeping the existing stop sign control and similar to what I just said about Heartland Trail and Old Sauk, the southbound approach is currently just an unmarked approach, adding lane designation markings to that. So going down to number six, Junction and Target Driveway, we're recommending maintaining the stop sign control. Old Middleton, Old Sauk, and Rosa, those two intersections that are very close to each other, that we're also recommending maintaining stop sign control. And then finally, Packers Avenue and 6, we're recommending maintaining the existing stop sign control, but adding that intersection to our ped bike project list, looking at a RFB and some pavement marking and signing improvements.
Questions, Grant?
On number two, or, well, number one, I think that sounds good. Number two, the traffic control. So that would be for both directions on Aberg would have a signal and just the Packers off-ramp. Is that, am I in the right location for what we're talking about here?
Yeah, it would be
the northbound off-ramp.
Yeah, the northbound off-ramp and then Aberg, similar to kind of the other side for the southbound direction.
Both of the off-ramp pieces would have their own separate signal control then, or?
Yes and no. I mean, it would be that they both have traffic signals to controlling them, but it would be, yes.
Okay. And that you would not anticipate a no turn on right turn on red on the rightbound one?
Do you remember?
No, we will be looking at ways to protect that that path because there weren't many bike or pedestrian crashes, but of the four that we did find, they were all the same type of northbound right and a westbound bike. So due to the consistency of those crashes, we would look at blank out boards or no turn on red signs or some type of.
We're actually, because some of the crashes there were bike crashes with that right turn, we're thinking about having an actual maybe a bike signal, mm-hmm. but we want it actuated by bicycles because one of the problems right now is that northbound movement is backing up so far, so we don't want to constrict it to, never turn right on red. Mm-hmm. So we would like to have that actuated for a bicycle and then have no right turn during that time when the bicycle movement is actuated.
Okay. Yeah, so I'm glad that's on your radar and just thinking about that crossing there because it's mm-hmm. a tough one. And I think my only other question or comment is on number eight. In terms of the RFBs on, so that's, I guess you'd call it a seven-lane road at that point. I'd heard in the past that there's some concerns about use of RFBs on, like six-plus lane roads. Is there any additional info you can share about the feasibility of that kind of an installation?
Yeah, we performed some studies at Packers and Schlingen, mm-hmm. and the yield rate to people using the RFB there was, if I remember right, I think it was 81% of 100%. Drivers who, within a certain distance back that had time to react, were stopping. based on that, I think we felt that was okay to keep that on the table as possible treatments.
I would also.
That actually is a very good point. It's a valid concern. We share those concerns as well when we got a request for RFPs for really wide roadways, such as East Washington Avenue, Packers Avenue. However, the reason is that the concern is mostly about the multiple thread issues, as one lane of traffic stopped for the pedestrian in the crosswalk. The vehicles in other lane didn't know about what's going on, so they continue to move and collided with the pedestrian as the vision is blocked by the stopped vehicle. So that is a valid concern. However, though, our reasoning is that that situation happens with or without an RFB. We believe that with RFB, the situation will be better. The danger is still there, but will be significantly reduced because now, when that happens, drivers in all the lanes saw the flashing lights, which gave them some hint that the vehicle in other lane is stopping for a pedestrian crossing the street. So we believe that it's there's some concerns, but it's a huge improvement over the existing condition. And we did install a few on East Washington Avenue and also on Packers City again. Our team actually did a study about how the principle of the yielding. So before installation, this is study at the Schneemingen and the Packers, same number of lanes. The yielding rate is below 20%. After the installation, the yielding rate is above 80%. So we think actually helps improve safety.
Great.
But it doesn't totally eliminate the concern.
That sounds great.
The intersection I had the most concern about was the East Washington and Blount, and one of the reasons for that was because of the pretty much constant traffic that's approaching it on East Washington, either from Blair or East Washington, Blair from either side. And I've been very impressed by the compliance of motorists yielding to pedestrians at that location.
Great question, though.
Just probably obvious, but if that could be activated by a button that's accessible from the road, not requiring to get off a 6 up onto a curb, like if it could be both ped and bike activated, basically would be really helpful there, because it would be an awkward spot to try and.
Yeah, that's a great point. We'll look into that. That's the same thing we're considering for West Main and Profit, because that's right over there. We know there are lots of bike users, so we want to. Not only pedestrians can activate it, but bikes can activate it as well.
And I would also just advocate to put this on the list of potential speed reduction streets also. So.
Mm-hmm. Good point.
Thanks.
Then number 8.
Number 8, yeah.
Other comments or questions?
Because I understand when you're back to number 2, the Aberg path, were you saying that's an actuated no right turn on red? Is that the idea?
When the button is pressed, because the main reason would be primarily for the bicycles that we were worried about the most. But if we're going to have a button, both the pedestrians and the bicyclists will press the button, and there would be a no right turn on red for when the bikes or peds are making that crossing.
So in that case, we'll use what we call blank out sign. So typically, it's black. When it's needed, it will be lighted up. Actually, it has more value than a full time sign because it would not stand out very well.
Right.
We have used it at a few locations. For example, John Hunter Drive and
where?
What's that?
Where?
John Hunter Drive at the north. North Shore, that big right turn from North Shore to right turn to Jonathan Drive. That's one improvement we made, and we got a good feedback from folks who have been using that pass crossing.
Ken and then Grant.
Brian, just to offend, is that no right turn sign at First and Johnson new? Is that part of the redevelop? I mean, that is really an effective sign.
Correct.
Yeah. That's the same sign as
That's exactly the type of sign we're talking about. It really does come up
boom
bright, yeah.
Yeah.
We had older ones previous to LEDs that were used primarily at locations that had some railroad crossings, like on John Nolan, there was a couple of median intersections where you didn't want to have a left turn or something like that, or some locations, even a right turn going across the tracks. But they didn't grab nearly as good as these new ones do.
Well, I think that's especially important because that intersection, if you're trying to pay attention, if you're making a right turn to pedestrians, and then those left turns on Johnson are so far away. I mean, you really have to have a split vision to keep track of everything. And it's so much safer when those left turns are coming to just say, just don't.
Well, right now, it used to be a single left turn lane, that I'm thinking. And they were able to make the permitted movement, which was always a dangerous thing. And we had the sign saying that, you know, yield to pedestrians. Turning movements yield to pedestrian signs. Now that movement is a protected. They can only make it on a green arrow. But the other movement, like the right turn movement, which is the one that you're talking about, does have that sign to protect that.
Yeah. A great sign. Not that I'm a big fan sign, but really.
Just on the same topic, as I didn't quite catch, I guess, what the proposal of that it wouldn't be no right all the time. My concern is, and maybe you can address it with placement of that blackout sign, but the normal scenario there is in that right-hand lane, people are staring left and don't ever look right. So if you had it, like if the signal is here, I roll up and push the button or it activates automatically, it says no turn on right on red, they're not likely going to see that until they're already rolling. So it's like I'm a little bit worried it wouldn't actually work. Certainly not for the car that's already there.
Oh, it's down. Oh, that light is, at first, is down a lot lower than your traffic.
Well, it's the only thing people are looking at this, because they're already, the car's like this, and they're basically staring and waiting for that gap. And as soon as they see it, they start driving, and it's just, I mean, you guys know what it is.
I understand. So. You're saying the car, the motors is
they're
looking
not
this
see
way
no turn on red.
And not looking ahead is exactly what you're saying.
Yep. So just think about that, because I worry that then it's almost worse then, because then if you push it, it says no turn on, and you think that you can go, especially for a less experienced cyclist, almost more risk that they're going to say, okay, well, light says I can go now. So maybe just give that a little more thought.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah. For that reason, I think for the sign at John Allen Drive, we put it on the left side. That's where the drivers are kind of looking at the cars coming at them. So I think here we probably consider police a sign over there as well. So where they are, where they're looking.
Yeah, I mean, I think placement is one part, and probably the bad example, or another bad example, is Highland and the Campus Drive off ramp, where people look left, and the sign, I think, is up high on the right, and therefore there's not a whole lot of yielding. And then the other problem, which I think I forwarded that complaint that people had about the one on Johnson, like people biking there, and apparently people still ignore, even if it's bright and all that, is a matter of when during the signal phase the no turn on red comes on, where like if you start the phase where you can turn, and then sometime during that cycle the light comes on, I think it is probably less effective than if the phase starts out, okay, I can't, it's red and I can turn, and then sometimes during the red I can start turning. I think that makes a difference as well.
Yeah, and that was one recent change that was made to Johnson First, was to bring that no right turn on red up when that inbound left was timing. That way it gives the drivers enough time not only to see the red but to see the blankout board, and then when the through gets a green and they still have a red and they still have the blankout board, prior to that, it's at least my theory that driver would come up, see the red arrow, would not see the blankout board, and then through gets a green, the bike gets a green, and then up pops the no turn on red. But at that point, that driver most likely was already kind of making their decision that they were going to go. So that was one change that we'll have to take a look at this intersection and kind of fine-tune to make it specific.
one more thing that just popped up on the, in my mind on this. Why someone would push the button? So do they not have a walk signal until they push that button? Because, I mean, otherwise they would already have the right of way because there's a red light. So
sure. Yeah. The push button, Brian was talking about the bike signal. So we can bring up by actuation, we can bring up a bike signal, which kind of provides a higher level protection, which the manual requires that you actually stop all the conflicting movements, conflicting vehicle movements for that. But I'd like Brian elaborate more on that if you have anything to add.
Yeah, I mean, typically you can have a walk, with a permitted right turn, a right turn on red. Whereas, Yang was just saying, the federal, the manual and uniform traffic control devices approval for these things, they do not allow you to have any permitted movement across a bicycle movement when it has a bicycle green. But if we're going to put a pedestrian, if we're going to put a button for the bikes, we're not going to, we wouldn't have two different buttons because, that's one of the things that is allowable by the MUTCD is to have a button where you can press it or press it longer to have a longer green. But it's always been my thought that, if you tell the pedestrian they can press it once or press it a couple of times or longer for a longer green, everybody's going to press the longer green anyways. So, if we're going to have a button for one, just make it work for both. And currently, there's not a large amount of pedestrians that are crossing right there anyways. I mean, I'm sure there are some pedestrians, but it's not a large amount. So I don't think it's going to be problematic to have the button for both.
I mean, it seems like cost allowing, this seems like a prime location to have an induction loop for bikes to activate the green. Because, I mean, I know often the concern is a lot of people will turn off and not actually use the green phase. But in this case, the only way you can go is straight. So having, with a good setback, having an induction loop to activate that, not bike signal, but pedestrian signal, might be nice.
Yeah, and that, again, with Johnson and First, that's another, that was another design we were kind of playing around with, was the, if you're heading outbound, it's only in the outbound direction, not the inbound. But if you're heading outbound, there is a loop cut into the pavement with a confirmation beacon. And actually that loop has a delay to try and address inbound cyclists who are kind of slowing down and then outbound who are kind of revving up. So there's a 1.2 second delay in that detector. So from watching the cameras there, it seems to be working. Anyone who rides over that detector and is slowing down puts a call in. Anyone who's kind of clipping it on their out or making a right turn, they're not calling the phase, so I've been pretty impressed with how that's worked.
However, though, nowadays some bikes have very little amount of metal in it, so they're not being detected by those detector. So I think as a default measure, we're going to still put a button over there. Mm-hmm. But with the goal, detecting most of bicycles and not to push a button. So just for a safe design, mm-hmm. We'll probably still push it, place the button over there.
And of course, there are camera-based systems as well, which I've seen.
The camera-based systems are getting better and better. We actually were testing some products. So the vendors are, the manufacturers are constantly improving their algorithm. So I think right now it's still not 100%, but they are getting much, much better every day. So we are keeping our eyes open for those as well.
Ken.
Move approval of the recommendations.
Second. A motion and a second. Further discussion?
I had one comment on item number 3. Have you talked to the intercity bus companies, what they think? Because as whenever I take the bus, there seems to be sometimes they try to make the left turn outright, sometimes they turn right and then like turn right onto Dutch Mill, I guess, and then make a U-turn, not taking the service drive along the parking lot. So that might just be something to think about. What are the intercity buses going to do there? And I mean, I guess one way would be to ban left turns coming out of the lot there, but
you see a lot of backups that are, you know, coming from Stoughton Road that, you know, are actually blocking this intersection a good deal of time as well, which would be very difficult for us to deal with because the that intersection is controlled by the state DOT.
Mm-hmm. Okay, further discussion? All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Any abstentions? Thank you very much. Next, item F4, creation of the Joint Traffic Calming Subcommittee of the Transportation Commission and the Transportation Policy and Planning Board. Excuse me, this is the subcommittee we talked about last time when we were talking about the Neighborhood Traffic Management Program. The purpose is outlined, the authority. The chair of the policy board will be is authorized to appoint members from the policy board to the committee, and I would be authorized to appoint members of the commission. And you can see we have split membership here so that everybody will be represented. And we're hoping to have a final product by October 15th unless both the TC and the TPPB extend that deadline.
Second.
Motion?
Second.
And a second? Discussion? All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried. And I have had a couple of people indicate they were interested. I'm also willing to serve as an alternate if that's needed. So if anybody else hasn't gotten in touch with me and you're interested, be sure and let me know. Okay. Next, Metro's request for a public hearing on March 11th with regard to proposed service changes, including some bus stop closures. Drew.
Yeah, I'm Drew Beck from Metro Transit. And first of all, thanks for wading through that rather sizable document. And I apologize that we don't have page numbers on there. I didn't even notice that until tonight. These changes are kind of in four basic areas. One of them is kind of the largest chunk of this is the Route 3 on-time performance issue that we've been talking about for so long. And that kind of goes into the bus stop changes too, thinning out some of the stops along that busy corridor, Jennifer Street and Atwood Avenue. Another part of this is kind of changing some of the east side routes to serve the new Penny Branch Library at Cottage Grove Road and just west of Dempsey Road there. Another area is UW campus. They had a large study, I think it was 2 years ago now, and they're trying to implement some of the recommendations of that study, and they've been working with us over that period. So we've been collaborating with them on the design of these routes. We did have a few disagreements over some of it, but by and large, I think it's actually an improvement in their service. I think it's going to be more reliable. And the rest of it, of course, is the various bus stop changes that are kind of not huge, just operationally they work better, or they they improve safety of the bus stop itself. So I don't know if you really want me to go all the way through this, or you want me just to describe bits of it. I don't know.
Chris?
I see we have a lot of time on the agenda. What would we like to achieve before the approving the hearing on the 11th?
So
If you have any questions about any of the proposals or items that you would like Metro to address, I would be very interested in hearing. There was a public outreach plan that was outlined. We had a lot of discussion at several of our meetings about the critical importance of having appropriate outreach. So any suggestions you have for outreach that maybe isn't there, or other things that you think that Metro might be able to do. I just want to make sure people realize there was an email that was brought forward with regard to the proposed changes on Route 67 with some concerns about the sidewalks in the area. So people going to Metcalf's Market would have quite a long walk, and there was some interesting comments about how many times people would have to cross the street, the fact that the sidewalk doesn't go through. So I just want to make sure that those concerns were brought forward and you guys take a look at that. So anything that you want them to take a look at before, as they're considering these changes, and we'll hear more about them at the public hearing. But I'm also really concerned about those the outreach as well. So are there any of the, hopefully everybody had a chance to read through all of the proposed changes, and we spent a lot of time talking about the Route 3 at prior meetings, understanding that some of these would need to be potentially, some bus stops would need to be consolidated. Concerns that people have, questions or things that you would like Metro to look at or other additional outreach? Chris?
So I saw two things that are going to be, I think, challenging in sort of understanding some of these proposed changes, and I found challenging. Regarding the comment on the, what is it, the 67? Mm-hmm. I think that raises a good point about the fact that one of these changes is meant to hit a library, and the other change seems to be moving away from a grocery store. So we don't really have articulated goals about how we decide whether something should be, you know, close to a stop or not. Mm-hmm. So I think that's one thing to consider. And then sort of just piggybacking on that, it's kind of hard to understand how these changes, if someone's familiar with the route, it's kind of clear what the implications of the changes are, but it's hard to understand how these changes fit into the system. So, like, if the three moves from one route to another, does that mean there's no more stop on one road or another? So I think those are going to be some challenges.
And did you have a suggestion as to how they could better address that and help us understand?
In time for March 11th, I'm not sure. I mean, I think...
Well, we're not going to... So the public hearing, we'll hear from the public, and then we won't take action until at least another meeting beyond that. So if there's additional research or additional things that we want them to take into consideration, you'll have an opportunity to mention that tonight. You'll have another opportunity after the public hearing to mention it, and then, you know, certainly another opportunity when we actually take it up for approval, but we're trying to get all the issues addressed, surfaced and addressed before we actually take it's proposed for actual approval. So you maybe think about that. Harold?
I mean, maybe in that spirit, and I have a comment on the Route 3. So the goal of this is to reduce the trip time to make sure that 50%, only 50% of buses arrive after the pulse as opposed to whatever they are right now. And so you have four components to achieving that. I think probably both for us but also for the public, it would be good to have a better understanding how much each of these changes, and I know you can't, this is not hard science, and you can't say, like, you know, this contributes 10%, this contributes 20%, but getting a rough idea of, like, okay, well, if we get overwhelming public feedback, as maybe it's not very unlikely that certain bus stops should not be eliminated, but we still implement the other three things, then is the expectation then, well, maybe that gets us to 60% of buses making it in time for the pulse. So that would be one comment about that.
That makes sense.
Ted.
So, Drew, this hasn't been published yet. There's still time to change this document or what?
Yes.
So here's what I think would give us a better public hearing, and sort of what Harold had said. I think a stronger preface on the Route 3 as far as what we're trying to accomplish and acknowledging that while there's some inconvenience for some people that will change on the inside, to try to emphasize a little bit more how important it is to meet the pulse at the transfer points. Because I think that's where our committee is sensitive to, and that we're not just doing this to be mean, to cut down on the number of stops, but the only way that we can really make sure that a lot of people don't get home an hour later than they should is to give us a decent chance of getting as many people as possible to those transfer points. And if somehow you can frame it that way, I think people will, I'm not discouraging people from coming and saying this is going to change my life and it's going to, you know, be inconvenient, but at least they can say, but there's a reason why we're doing that. And I think that reason really isn't articulated in this document as well as it could be.
Yeah, and I think part of it is because there was another document where you spent a lot of time just talking about that.
Right.
So I think Ken's suggesting you take some of that and add it to this document.
Mm-hmm.
So then instead of having to go someplace else to find that, it's right there for people
there, yeah.
to see.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Chris.
So I do have a suggestion, and you'll see why I paused to ask if it was doable by the 11th. But basically what it comes down to is presenting these changes in terms of something like an accessibility measure. So what these changes are meant to do is to increase or shorten the time that it would take an average person to get from point A to point B. Maybe the point B is the library. Right. So there's an assumption that making these changes might improve someone's access to the library. And I think putting these changes in terms of what is the average person's access to key destinations would let us articulate what we're trying to accomplish with some of these changes. And I know this isn't within your capability probably right now. And it also involves a conversation about, like, what are our goals? We're trying to improve access to libraries, access to groceries, access to jobs for the average person. So I think that's kind of at the heart of what we're trying to do here.
Yep. And you know, make it more consistent and reliable is the other kind of part of that.
Well, I think that you and Ken are both saying the same thing, and that's to better explain why you're recommending these changes so that people can understand. Is that?
Yeah,
is
and
that
it would also let us, the point that I raised earlier about, well, we're moving one route from one road to another, but that may or may not affect the ability of a person to reach these key destinations because of other routes that they have access to. It kind of like brings everything together.
Grant.
In terms of the outreach question that was raised, so again, I think, you know, Route 3 changes are you know, sort of more significant in addition to the, you know, meeting the pulse and the reliability component, which is obviously one of the goals. I think also just a broader goal is to, for those riders that are coming from further out, to have a shorter trip as well, right? Less stopping. And so I think it would be really helpful to get out to the East Transfer Point and talk with people that are getting on the 3 at the East Transfer Point inbound, who, you know, will be going through likely a large section of this area, and get their feedback around the proposed changes. And those are, you know, also folks that may be less likely to show up. and maybe less, you know, maybe supportive of the changes to have less stops because it'd get them through faster. So I think that would be a really good target population to get some feedback from. And I just had one specific clarifying question on the map. Yeah, we don't have page numbers, but on the Atwood section, there's a red X. It looks like it's by one of the Elmside stops, but I'm not. Maybe it's for the one next to it. I just don't quite know what that red X is. It looks like it's not on both of them. So the Elmside Marquette stops look like they says they're shifting location. Then there's a red X.
Oh, yeah.
Is that the page that you're on, Grant, behind?
So the scale of this, yeah. I spend a lot of time thinking about the scale of this, of how to present this information. I wanted to kind of put everything together onto one 8.5 by 11 sheet of paper so that you're not flipping and stuff like that. But on the other hand, there's a lot of detail. On those particular stops, what happens is they move, but it's hard to, if the rectangles would overlap if I moved them. So I kind of made this like hatch pattern. They're kind of moving. They're kind of closing and they're kind of opening a new one, but they're just moving a little bit. Anyway, what we're doing is the stops that are just slightly west of Fair Oaks are nominally moving like a half a block east and becoming nominally Fair Oaks Avenue stops. And then we'll have stops at Fair Oaks, just west of Fair Oaks. And then we'll have stops at Wabisa. And so the stops that are nominally today Marquette / Elmside stops will be moved slightly to the east and become Fair Oaks Avenue stops. So like westbound, I think we're far side of Marquette. And so we move effectively near side to the end of the previous block. So it's not far enough to actually move the rectangle on the map. And then Elmside is the same thing. I think we move like half a block east and from far side Elmside to near side Fair Oaks.
So Grant, would it be helpful if they added some language in the document that explained it if you can't see it in the picture?
Well, and there was, if you read the box underneath it, that's basically what it says.
Yeah, it was that red X there, then under.
Right. Oh, okay, I'm sorry. The red X is, so that is a stop that is closing westbound Fair Oaks near side of Atwood. That is for Route 7, which only operates on weekends.
Okay, so not related to.
Yeah, it's just, so as we move that stop, like, half a block east to be closer to Fair Oaks, then it just becomes right around the corner from that stop. So then we close that Route 7 stop, which is really too close to that one, even at Marquette Street. But
so maybe just move that little red X, if you can, over to make it obvious that it's for that one and not the Marquette stop.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Drew or Mike, Route 67. Tell me in blunt words what's happening on the dotted red. Is it like if suddenly the streets were, you never had problems in the wintertime, does that help keep it where it is? I mean, I don't think we're really, well, maybe we are. Are we really thinking that we're going to capture a whole lot more riders if under the proposed route by moving it out to High Point, or is the issue going through West Town that depending on the time of the year, the bus just gets jammed up because of shoppers not knowing how they're going to get through that?
The couple goals here with Route 67. First of all, we operate on streets that we don't like. We turn left on Ganser. And that's a steep hill, and going up in the winter, we can get stuck on Ganser, actually. And then the other part of it is going through the interior of the mall roads. It's a private road. The pavement is in poor condition. We have those stop signs that are in kind of not the way we want them to be. And in the past, Metro's had a lot of routes that look like that. For example, we used to kind of wind around Easttown Mall. We don't do that anymore.
And so the goal is to get the 67 off of Ganser and get it off of the interior of the mall. The other goal was to make the 67 easier to use. So we have the other route out there is Route 15. And so now routes 15 and 67 will follow the same pattern. So, for example, if you just want to get on a bus, go downtown, you go to the same stops. It's the same stop going in sort of the same direction. You don't have to think, do I take the 67 or do I take the 15 and where do I go for which one and what time is it and so forth. The other issue is by pulling it off of the slow streets on the mall and pushing it out as far as we can on arterial streets, we can get it farther out towards High Point, and there's a lot of residential density out there by Tree Lane, and some of it is low income. And on the weekends, Route 15 does not operate, and so we think that by pushing it out a little farther, we can help some of those people and push it out a little farther and get more utility out of the 30 minutes that we have to cycle that route.
So I'll recommend, like I did before, I think you just have to be more blunt as far as saying, this is what we get out of doing this. And just make, I mean, I don't know if you have data of how many times your buses have gotten stuck on Ganser, and I'm not saying make it up, but I'm just saying, I think people respond if you say, while this may only happen 24 times a year, it has profound effect on that bus and the ridership and the system when we get a bus stuck on there, or the same thing for it really can in Christmas time get pretty constipated, this particular route, and that just throws you off by 20-30 minutes and all. So you just have to nail it, you know, right away, because this is way too euphemistic as far as what you're trying to accomplish on that. And according to that, if this is all I had, I'd keep the Metcalf staff. Right. You know what I mean? I need more, and I think you should put more on the paper as far as why it has an overall positive.
Yeah, point taken. Thank you. Okay. The other issue I forgot is if you've ever been in there, like especially that mall right on the corner where we turn onto the mall road,
that's an impossible corner.
Well, it's just this dinky little awful stop, and it's, you know, you're parking lots in all directions, and it's just a very poor.
Well, usually the drivers who are crowding and aiming toward the shopping mall itself keep a right-hand driver from making the arc. You don't have enough real room. I mean, according to most of your other trajectories, when Tom's here or whatever and says, how much room do you need to make a right turn? You can't make it.
Yeah, it is a tight one. Mm-hmm.
And Harold, if I can just go back to what Chris said earlier about not providing as good a service to a grocery store. I mean, this just says you're not going to provide better service to a grocery store. It doesn't say why that's okay. It doesn't justify it. And that's, I mean, it's of concern to me personally. Obviously, Chris mentioned it. We've gotten feedback already from somebody with regard to that. So if there is adequate justification, which Ken is talking about, you got to be blunt and say, we recognize that this is the trade-off. And this is why we think it's acceptable to make that trade-off. So, Carl?
One maybe actually doable suggestion. So you refer to the staff spacing guidelines quite a bit. And so in the chart that has the stop consolidation on Jennifer Atwood and Walter, actually including the distance between the stops, both before and after the consolidation, I mean, I don't really think it's going to sway a lot of the public, but I think it's good information for us to see, like, oh, our guidelines are, what is it, 1,000 feet? I mean, because these are stops every block.
Mm-hmm. That's a good point. We can do that. I actually did have that, and then things were moving around, and we started moving stops, so I just took it out because I didn't know what I'd have ready in time. But we can add that. The other point I want to make on that, since you brought it up, just so that you're aware, we kind of had two alternatives of the stop spacing plan. And the one that we have deletes the stop on Hudson and Corey, which is kind of the only traffic signal in the area. So the plan that we have chosen to show kind of relies on, or you know, to some degree relies on some kind of intersection improvements at preferably Ohio and Wabisa. So we've been working with traffic engineering staff and that has been very helpful. And so that, we're, that is kind of part of the plan, is that we will have Ohio, I think that RFB is planning to go in 21, and Wabisa is that next year, this year?
I think 21.
21.
Can I, as long as we're on this page, can I just sneak in a comment if nobody objects? It says estimated weekday boardings from March of 2019. So it's a year old data.
We do it. So
it just, you know, that seems pretty old.
Oh, okay, so we do to whenever somebody gets on a bus, we can do a very arduous process to figure out, based on the time and the bus number and the route and the direction, we can guess which stop they got on at. It really only works when buses aren't on detour, and there's like a 3-week window in the spring and like a 3-week window in the fall when it's not detour season, it's not holidays, it's not any, you know, Christmas, winter break, spring break, and all of that. So we do the analysis every year in March, and so it's almost March, so we'll have 2020 data soon.
Makes sense.
Harold?
One more thing about a stop consolidation. Would you envision that by reducing the number of stops that might provide an opportunity to improve the remaining stops in terms of better amenities with benches, shelters, and all that? Because, I mean, that's something that I hear a lot, that, yeah, you have to post. If you're lucky, you have a concrete pad, but that's that. And I think there's pretty good research saying, like, if you have nicer stops, people perceive the waiting time to be less and might be more accepting of having a longer walk to that stop. So if that is something that you think is possible, I mean, advertising that might not be a bad strategy.
We can take a look at that. One part of this is that we're doing the concrete boarding platforms in some districts with the sidewalk program. And so some of these, especially if you look at the bus stop changes at the end, some of these kind of coincide where, okay, if we're going to go in and put the platforms in, we want to put them in where we really want the stops, not just sort of where they are. So they will, for example, Johnson Gorham between State and North Hamilton, for example, we have one bus stop there that's not accessible. It's stairs on, what is that, Gorham and Pinckney, I think. So one of the goals was to get rid of that and put that in an accessible location with a traffic signal and platform. But yeah, we can look at the shelters and benches.
Kind of a similar comment, maybe easier to do, is put the cost for maintaining the stop in here. So even just like winter maintenance thing, I know it's not, I mean, that's, I don't think you guys don't pay for it yet, at least, but I think it's a good information to have in here that if we remove 10 stops, what is the, you know, annual cost to simply maintain them? And maybe you can add in also, you know, replacing benches, et cetera, if that applies. But I think that should be part of our consideration is, yeah, fewer stops, they could be nicer, and also we have some real constraints on the winter maintenance side of things. So,
mm-hmm. Other comments?
With those, with the understanding that Drew and others will modify that, I would move approval of the notice of public hearing.
Is there a second?
Second.
There's a motion and a second with the understanding that all of the feedback that you've gotten would be incorporated into the document. Further discussion? All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried. If you have any other ideas about outreach, just, you know, shoot an email to Mick. And if you don't have Mick's email, send it to Patrick and he'll forward it to Mick. Because I think we've had lots of conversation about, making sure we get to the right people, because not everybody is comfortable coming to the Transportation Commission in front of a large group at a public hearing. And so, you know, I think you guys do a great job of reaching out, trying to find all the right people. So any ideas that people have, Bill?
Has discussion gone on to the alders that are most impacted?
Yeah, well, yeah.
To whether they want to have neighborhood meetings or something like that in lieu of before the hearing?
Yeah.
Is the main beneficiary of Route 3 westbound meeting the pulse at that transfer point over by
Bantoke. Yeah.
Then it would be helpful if you could identify, put a marketing basically at that transfer point, and if somebody would be generous enough to come and say, this would really help my life. It's always nice to have somebody testify who says thank you, or
yeah,
this would help. I mean, I think we can figure that out as well. But generally, for public hearings, it's going to be the people whose lives are changed negatively, as opposed to people in general say, well, whatever.
Yeah, yeah. I think that would apply to both ends of the route, east and west.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
That's a very good idea.
Yeah, and that reinforces a conversation we had when we were talking about the speed humps on Spade Street, because the bus stops in that particular neighborhood, people in that particular neighborhood may object, but the people riding the whole route are the ones who are going to benefit, and those are the people we want to hear from as well. So it's this theme we've been talking about. It's not just that localized feedback that we need, because these things impact much, much wider audience. So challenging for you to get that info out. But if there's a way to get info to the people who are riding the Route 3 end-to-end, you know, those are the folks that are going to be real helpful to hear from. Other comments, Grant?
Just a confirms, is it, what time is the public hearing going to
be? At 6 o'clock.
6 p.m. on March 11th.
That's correct.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Right?
Mm-hmm.
Yep. And we usually start the public hearings at 6, just to give people a little bit more time to get here. Mick, did you have any other comments or questions?
I'm good.
Okay.
But thank you.
Okay. All right, thanks.
Thank you.
Find my agenda here. All right. City Engineering 2020 Projects Review and Feedback. Who do we have?
Fadi Musa, City Engineering. I'm Tom Moore with City Traffic Engineering. So tonight we're going to talk about the Anderson Street resurfacing project. The project limits are Anderson Street from Rice Street to North Stoughton Road. Basically, we have two options. We have three options. I believe you have two options on your agenda. The third one, basically we held a public information meeting yesterday night, and not a lot of people showed up, but we got some feedback, and then we created a third option, which I have it here.
Oh, we didn't get a third option, did we, Patrick? Yeah, I don't think we saw a third option. I think we saw two.
Yes. I can open it once I describe the first two.
Okay.
So basically, we're planning to resurface Anderson Street from Wright Street to North Stoughton Road. Currently, the pavement rating is a 4. We ranked the quality of the pavement from 1 to 10, 1 being the worst and 10 being the best quality. So basically, that's the determining factor why we're going to work on the what we're going to do on the project. So we're going to take advantage of that and include some bicycle facilities with it. So basically, that gives us those three options. On the first option that we have here, we are planning to include a 10-foot wide shared use path on the south side of Anderson Street that would be represented by the blue line on the south side. Also, we are planning to include two bike lanes, 6 feet wide bike lanes, one eastbound and one westbound. The eastbound is on the south side, the westbound is on the west side. Yes.
Just to clarify, though, that's a 4-foot bike lane plus a 2-foot gutter pan.
That is correct.
I think it's just important to clarify that.
Yeah, that's accurate. So to do that, to accommodate those two bike lanes, we're planning to widen the street on the south side by 6 feet. That would be represented by the black thick line. I'm going to try to zoom in. So here, we're planning to widen the street by 6 feet, and that would give us the opportunity to include that 6 feet wide bicycle lane going eastbound. And also, to accommodate the bike lane on the north side going westbound, we're planning to widen the street 3.5 feet on the northeast corner of the intersection with Stoughton Road. So basically, that would be option one. Option two, here real quick. So option two is kind of similar with option one in terms of that we're proposing the shared use path on the south side too. And also we're proposing a 6 feet wide bike lane on the north side going eastbound. To do that, the same thing will happen here in the northeast corner, which we're widening the street by 3.5 feet. The main difference would be that we're not including a bike lane on the south side because we're not planning to remove or replace the curb. After we pass the second driveway from left to right, the street gets wider, and that gives us the opportunity to accommodate a 7 feet wide bike lane heading west towards North Stoughton Road. So that would be option two, and those were the two options that you have on your agenda and were presenting yesterday at the public informational meeting. So the third option would be this one. So the third option still proposed the 10 feet wide shared use path on the south side. And we are planning to replace the curb on the south side. Basically, from the west end of the project to the mid block, we're proposing to widen the street by 3 feet to accommodate a 7 feet wide bike lane on the north side here, but we are not proposing any bike lane on the south side. From mid block to the east end, basically, if you can take a look at this driveway here, we are planning to reduce the width of the travel lane to basically widen the terrace a little bit and have more space between the shared use path and the travel lanes. And that will continue on till North Stoughton Road. So that's basically a brief description of what's going on with the third option.
Did you say that you, can I just
yes.
ask you to repeat, did you say that you developed the third option as a result of the feedback that you received?
That is correct. Yes.
Feedback from the neighbors, from the bike path users, from?
No, so the elder of the district was present, basically he was the only person that showed up at the meeting.
Okay.
No, we did not have a lot of people going there. So basically, we incorporated that on the third option. Yes.
I just wanted to make sure everybody understood where the third option came from, Grant.
Yeah, yes. Maybe just to kind of boil it down. So basically the third option is like the second option, but instead of creating that eastbound bike lane for the last little bit again, instead of doing that, it widens the terrace and then also allows for the westbound bike lane to be a foot wider. So instead of just a 4-foot wide lane, it would be a 5-foot on the westbound direction. So I think that's really the key.
That is correct. Yes.
Okay, comments or questions?
So I am elder of this district and I did show up at that meeting last night. I'm in favor of the option three. I think historically we've done a number of projects where we do a sort of side path, a shared use path, plus on-street bike lanes. The concept of doing both of those things is to sort of meet different user style preferences. So you have your sort of confident cyclist who wants to stay on the road and go fast, so they have the bike lanes, and then you have your shared use path for your less confident riders. I've always thought that was a little suspicious approach and think that generally we should be designing for the broadest array of users, which is in something like a shared use path. I think we should also be pushing ourselves to build shared use paths that can accommodate people that like to ride fast well also. And in terms of just thinking about sustainability, et cetera, when we take that kind of approach and we just kind of build everything we can, you also just get wider roads, et cetera. So I've always kind of been in the camp of let's do something like a shared use path where it makes sense because it'll serve the most number of people. Let's make sure it works well for everybody. And then we really shouldn't have to have something like, again, in this case, an unbuffered, you know, very narrow lane on a 4-lane road that's moving pretty quick. Like the number of people that I think that facility serves is very little. Particularly in this scenario, I think the vast majority of users are going to be coming up off of the path through the, I forget the name of the area there. It's basically part of the greenway that comes all the way up from like Highway 30 and brings you up to Anderson, curves around and comes to Wright Street already. Theoretically, you could have some people that ride from the airport and all the way down Anderson, but as long as they can transition onto that shared use path, I see very little advantage to keeping an on-street bike lane. So given the benefits of having a little bit wider westbound lane, which I do think has some value, so if you are westbound and you're not wanting to come all the way over, it sort of makes a little bit more sense. But making that a little bit wider, and then also there were some sections of the terrace that were really skinny, and when you have that scenario, it's common that you get snow pushed up by the plows all the way over the terrace and into the path, so then it influences how accessible the path is during the wintertime as well. And then at the intersection with Stoughton Road, you shouldn't really have any bicycle users that are eastbound and they're going to turn onto Stoughton Road in either direction. So again, there's no advantage to getting them back into the street there. That really the only movement that's going to happen is crossing Stoughton Road. And so I think with this design, it gets you up onto the island where you have to hit the call button anyway. And from there, you can then turn back into a road user. So in my opinion, I think that option three works well.
Harold.
Yeah, maybe that's a good point. So as you said, like the bike movement will be straight across Stoughton Road, But if you're on the path, that basically turns this into a two-stage crossing, right? Whereas, I mean, that would be one of the advantages of having the eastbound bike lane, at least for that last little bit, that you transition onto the road and then you cross with the cars rather than having to go across the island, right?
I don't know if it'd be, I don't know if we know what the signal operation is there, but I don't think there's a like free flow right lane there. So basically if you know, if there's a red light, you should be able to make that, I guess, technically it's another stage, I guess, but that crossing of the right turn lane, I don't think is on a separate phase. So it really isn't, like, basically you're either going to do it there or you're going to do it in an uncontrolled manner a block earlier, and you still have to sort of navigate those right turning cars. So I think it's a safer place to do it right there, and I don't think effectively it would be a two-stage crossing.
Jim Wolf with City Engineering. Just a quick add-on to that right turn discussion. That is a add-on right turn lane onto Stoughton Road. So turning off onto Anderson, you kind of have your own lane that you're turning into on Stoughton Road. So I think it does operate almost as a free flow right turn lane. I don't think it's signalized separately because of that issue.
So is there a crossing, a ped crossing light, or what is the?
I believe there's a ped crossing light. Actually,
not on Street View.
I don't think there is. I think it's just a marked crosswalk across the right turn lane.
Yeah, I mean, Street View just has a crosswalk.
Just a crosswalk.
But that's from 2016, but I'm not sure if anything has changed there. So, I mean, yeah, that would be one of my concerns, that you have the right turning traffic basically and not stopping and going through at full speed. So that probably is not, I mean, maybe that would need to be an improvement then to signalize that.
So, I mean, I think that's a good point, and it probably should be looked at. If you look at the sort of broader bike network here, so this is, again, a low-stress shared-use path that comes up through here. There's a whole bunch of low-income housing on this corner of tons of kids. And then when you cross Stoughton Road, it's a little bit weird, but basically you get behind the gas station, and now you're on a low-stress route again that connects to Rheindahl Park, which is where the new library is going to be. And so this area, as a low-stress bike connection, I think is incredibly critical. So if we're not confident with this crossing of the shared use path, I think we need to fix that as a priority, because the other, I don't know if you pull up option one again, but
yes.
You know, basically the way that would work is, you know, maybe technically it's faster for someone who's very experienced and confident, but the mixing that's going to happen there, I mean, where you would choose to do that, and then you're going to basically have this, that same right hand or right turning car traffic is going to come across the bike lane also. So it's, I think maybe some improvements might be needed there, but we probably have a better, safer, controlled place to do that if we do it actually at the corner, I guess would be my thought.
Ken?
What action do we?
This is not an action item. This is an info. They're just asking for our feedback.
Okay.
So maybe then we should talk about westbound traffic coming through the weird gas station connection to Rheindahl Path crossing. And then, yeah, if you're fine with going into the bike lane, that works for you. But I guess getting to the multi-use path on the south side, that's going to be... Is that even possible? I guess there is a crossing there. But, yeah, you would have to go across Stoughton Road, wait in the island, then go across to the other island, and then do the other crossing. So I guess maybe, yeah, the bottom line is intersection improvements would need to come with this at one point or the other.
We can look at those options.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And we have some restrictions because this is a state highway there, so obviously it would require that coordination. I just
That's key, yeah.
Yeah, and I'm assuming there's no crosswalk on that side because of the left-hand turns onto southbound Stoughton, but that might be one of the things that we could raise with the state is seeing what it would take to get a crosswalk there, because I think, again, for those sort of typical users, that might be that rather than, because that's going to be a five-stage crossing then, essentially. So that would probably be a good conversation to start with the state.
Yep.
Okay. Any other feedback? And if you could get a copy of alternative three to Patrick so we can save it in Legistar, please.
Yes. Oh, not a problem.
Okay. Any other comments on this one? Okay. How about Rock Stream Drive? Thank you.
Hello, everybody. My name is Andy Zwig. I'm from City Engineering. I'm the project manager for the Rock Stream Maple Grove development. This is Sean Malloy from Traffic Engineering. So we're here to just get some input on the new proposal to continue Rock Stream Drive from where it dead ends right now and connect it into Maple Grove Drive. We'll also connect Ambleside Drive to Rock Stream Drive. The Rock Stream and Ambleside is a public works project. It goes through the public meeting process, assessment process, board and council. We had a public meeting for this project 2 weeks ago on January 29th. The extension of Fairhaven to Manchester and Manchester to Rock Stream is a private development project that will have, that is currently, a developer agreement is currently in the works. Mm. So City Engineering will design those streets, release the plans to the developer. The developer will build them and turn those streets over to the city. There are also improvements to Maple Grove Drive. That is also a part of the private development project. Talk about Fairhaven and Manchester and Maple Grove a little bit because they all tie together. Manchester will be a 48-foot street that's going to have two through lanes, or a through lane in each, traffic in each direction, bike lanes, and parking, and those bike lanes are just extended from the existing Manchester road that's already built. Fairhaven will connect, and then Maple Grove Drive, there's a section between the school and that condo on the west side that's currently rural. It has a shoulder, so we're going to propose to put curb and gutter there, the bike lane, the parking lane, and sidewalk to connect the west side of the street. So I did check with Metro, and they are thinking about having Chester and Rockstream be a future transit route. We did talk about that at the public meeting, but any formal changes, you know, obviously have to get approved by public hearing and you know, various committees. So we did mention it, but that's all we took it that far. We didn't tell them what was going to happen, but we mentioned it because they're being designed, you know, to kind of accommodate that in the future, at least like the pavement thickness and the widths. We do cross Badger Mill Creek, Rockstream crosses Badger Mill Creek. So we will accommodate the stormwater drainage through there. We did present the neighborhood plan. This is from 2017. This was adopted from the 1993 neighborhood plan. So it does show, this development is shown in the red square. It does show a connection of Rock Stream to Maple Grove Drive. We've tweaked the connection location a little bit, but it is in the neighborhood plan. And the existing street network does kind of fit the 2017 plan. Here is the overall developer plan for the site. Lots 1, 2, and 3 are going to be apartments, multifamily units. Outlots 1 and 2 are for stormwater management. Outlots 3 and 5 are for the existing drainage channel that's there. Outlot 4 is a future development. And then Outlot 6 is dedicated to parkland. I should mention that Rockstream does have a multi-use path along the entire west side. That path will connect to the existing multi-use path and be adjacent to the school. We will be currently the south side, south school entrance does, the existing driveway overlaps Rockstream Drive, so we will be removing that access and then putting a road there and just connecting their driveways to the school. So their entrance from the south side doesn't change. It's just off a public street instead of a private driveway. All the streets do have 5 feet of sidewalk on each side. I think that's about it. Does anyone have any questions?
Questions or comments? Chris and then Grant.
Have there been any that you know of speeding or traffic calming complaints in the existing neighborhood to the west?
There, at the public meeting, that did not come up. There were concerns at Ambleside. There were questions about what kind of control will be at Ambleside and Rockstream. And as of right now, there would just be stop signs at Ambleside. But I know TE was possibly thinking about some options at Rockstream at Ambleside there because it did come up at the public meeting.
Yeah, we looked at a few options, but ultimately, we think, you know, with the street width being 32 feet there, and it's relatively narrow, that we don't foresee any issues. We'd be hesitant to put in anything like a speed hump there due to, you know, potential metro future route can create issues. So at this point, we don't plan on doing anything extra there for traffic calming.
Did, so in the past few years, we did hear complaints and requests from residents living on Manchester regarding speeding issues. So we have responded to that. Again, because of the fire operation and I believe Metrobus maybe as well, we'll not be able to do speed humps on Manchester. What we did is that we actually removed the parking from one side and marked the bike lanes, center lines, making the street looks much narrower than before. So I think that kind of work, works to some degree, but didn't totally solve the problem. So that's kind of the traffic calming related request we got over there. I was not aware of anything immediate to the west.
Yeah, thanks. I'm kind of trying to get a sense of the different road widths. So it looks like 32 feet for much of it, maybe 40 feet on Fairhaven, 48 on Manchester. can you speak to kind of what why those decisions were for those different widths on those?
Yep. Yep.
Yeah. So on Manchester, I'll start there. We went with 48 feet as the width. You know, recently on some of our collector streets, we previously did 44 feet and 46, and we found that the bike lanes would be constricted, especially during winter times. So it was a 7-foot parking lane and a 5-foot bike lane. So 48, you can do an 8-foot parking lane, 6-foot bike lane, gives more room for bikes, especially during winter time. So that's why we chose 48 there.
Let me jump in for one sec. We do have bump outs that we've put in on Manchester at Fairhaven and also Manchester at Rockstream to shorten those pedestrian crossings, restrict parking through there. So I just wanted to throw that out there. Please continue, Sean.
Yeah, and with Rockstream Drive, the existing portion was 32, so we matched that. And hopefully it, you know, helps. You know, we narrowed the street and have a, you know, pretty tight radius there. Hopefully that, you know, kind of works as a little bit of traffic calming. And then we went a little wider near the park and near the denser apartments because we're expecting some on-street parking. Typically when we have residential buildings, multifamily buildings, we have more on-street parking. So that's a denser on-street parking. So that's why we went with 36 on that portion.
Let me jump in again. So Rockstream, where it's 32, where it crosses the drainage channel, we want to keep as – it'd be nice if we could keep it as narrow as we can because we do have 12 by 5 box culverts that are 100 feet long that have to be put in. So if we keep in the street at 32, trying to minimize those box culvert lengths as much as we can. So that's another reason why it'd be try to minimize it through the drainage channel there. We can continue.
This is maybe a question. Well,
can you just, sorry, did you have something else?
Yeah, well, like the 40-foot on Fairhaven.
Yeah, so currently there's 40 feet on Fairhaven. That's what's there. So we kept that consistent with what, you know, was there existing. I suppose we could, as we go around that curve, we could narrow it if we wanted to. Maybe that would be a good idea. We can take a look at that. That we just kept it with what was there, but we can take a look if that's what you're getting at.
And then the 43 up at the top of Rockstream?
Yeah, that's intended to have a right and a left turn lane and a receiving lane for school bus size turning movements.
So mostly just up towards the intersection?
Yep, yeah, and then it narrows down to 36.
36, right.
So, that all makes sense, then. Thank you for that. I was kind of looking at the satellite views for, you know, the rest of kind of the Rockstream area, which are, I think those are all single-family homes. And in those kind of neighborhoods, like looking on satellite view, there's, you know, maybe 3 cars parked on the street at this moment in time for, you know, 6-8 blocks or something. And that's kind of like my neighborhood. And in those cases, 32 feet is really wide, actually, when nobody's parking on the street. Mm-hmm. So I know that with this development, there is higher density housing. And so I think we could expect to see more on-street parking in there. But I would just be really in favor of not really, really trying to predict what we are anticipating for on-street parking. And if we aren't confident that we'll get at least half of a street filled up, then I think we should look at only having parking on one side of the street, because that's really, I think, when, in my experience, we, in these residential areas, you have 32-foot wide, very few cars parked, all of a sudden it really does instigate that high speed. So I would maybe just go back and kind of look at that and consider, you know, maybe even that where the box culvert area is, for example, like, do you need parking in that area, right, going over the bridge? If not, like, bring it down to, you know, 24 feet or something and just have it be skinny. Also, I really do like the bump outs that you've done on Manchester there. Those are really great. I don't know if it's possible, but doing some chokers off of Maple Grove for those as well. I know you were talking about maybe having some
buses come in there, but I'm assuming those are, that would be like through movement on Manchester, right, is what you were saying?
I think that was one of the options. I'm not sure if they were going to go south on Maple Grove, but if they did, I'd imagine Manchester would be a location for a stop. But I can ask Metro. I don't even know if they have service right now on Maple Grove, but I can work with them and see if, you know, they were looking at that location.
And maybe it would still work with the turning radius anyways, but though I think particularly when you're going from a busier road to those local side connections, those are really great points to put those chokers, because it really helps signal a transition and slow people down as they're coming off of a, you know, a little bit more major street or onto a more residential. So if you can get those in there, I'd love to see them on there as well. Thanks.
And one other thing to note, we are working with the school, and we have heard concerns about pedestrians crossing Maple Grove. So I think their traffic engineering was reviewing a PED push light at the Rockstream intersection, and then probably putting in conduit at Manchester and Maple Grove for a future signal, but no planned signal with any of this construction.
3 points. So first is also along the lines of providing on-street parking, and I think I would also, yeah. I mean, partly it's just, you say, you know, there's going to be higher density apartments, buildings, therefore there will be more on-street parking. Well, if you provide that on-street parking and looking at the developer's plans, I mean, there seems to be plenty of parking constructed as part of the development, and so really thinking about, well, what do we need to provide for on-street parking and trying to minimize that, because I think, yeah, it really does help keeping roadways more narrow, which is cheaper to build, cheaper to maintain, reduces runoff. So I think that's a really good point. The second point is so the new street will replace the driveway to the school, and there will be the separate multi-use path north of the new street. And so there you have the driveway crossing the multi-use path, and presumably that driveway is actually going to be heavily used, at least during, I think it looks like that's probably the main school drop-off point with all the buses. So thinking about how that crossing can be built, that's very clear. This is a crossing. The crossing has the right-of-way that people don't cross without looking. Right. I'm not sure. I mean, that multi-use path is probably not going to have a ton of traffic, which sometimes actually makes it worse because then you're not expecting anybody there. And so, yeah, taking that into mind. And then the third thing was about Maple Grove Drive. So can you maybe repeat what the changes? You mentioned there might be a bike lane and a parking lane on...
Yep. So right now in Maple Grove, northbound is it's a parking / bike lane. It only has one stripe. It's
48 feet.
So that's on northbound. Then the southbound will have the same a parking lane / bike lane with curb and gutter and sidewalk that doesn't exist. In that section south of the school till you get to that first condo development. Currently there is no parking or really there is no bike lane in that section. It's just the 3 foot shoulder or 2 foot mm-hmm. shoulder. So there would be a more distinct parking, bike lane, sidewalk, curb and gutter.
Mm-hmm. For part of it, right? So that would end... Where the new, or is that for the whole stretch of Maple Grove?
Yeah, like in the, so what's ever down here, we're just gonna, which is a bike lane / parking lane, curb and gutter and sidewalk. We'll just continue that same section
okay.
all the way to the school. And when we get to the school, Maple Grove widens out a little bit, because that's where. No more school drop-offs and pickup. And also the school has hired their own engineer to review their flow of drop-off and pickup. So we'll be working with the school and their engineer on any changes they make
with their project also. Yep.
Thank you.
Other comments?
One last one, I do.
Sure.
Yeah. Just, I thought Harold made a good point about the multi-use path by the school entrance there, and if possible, one of the best ways you can, I mean, besides like pavement markings, et cetera, is if you could push that path to the north at all, basically get more distance between the road and the path. It allows when the cars turn, they're more squared up by the time they're crossing, and it really improves that, reduces that danger. So it looks like it's just lawn from here, but who knows what it actually looks like, or if it requires, you know, dealing with the school or anything. But if it's possible, yeah, just sliding the path, you know, a bit more north, I think would improve or reduce the conflicts there or the danger there.
And we're meeting with the school on Friday, so I'll bring that up to them and see if they have that concern, if they're concerned about that path going through their busy driveways. So, yep, okay.
Any other comments?
To pay the significant through drive from Manchester across Maple Grove. I mean, right now, as I see it, Manchester sort of provides a little shortcut up to McKee, goes past the park and things like that. I looked at the bigger map. I don't see any destination really on Rock Stream or anything like that as you're moving. It just sort of dead ends into just a residential neighborhood, right?
Yep. So really East Pass is really your only east-west connection here. And I think we can elaborate too. I think we're probably going to take some traffic off of East Pass. You know, people that live more in the southwest corner that would take East Pass to Maple Grove to PD will take Rock Stream. But you can maybe talk about the sure cars you're anticipating.
Yeah, so East Pass currently has about 2,900 vehicles, and that's in the one access point between Cross Country and McKee. So opening up these two access points will disperse, you know, that traffic that we're seeing. So we can, you know, anticipate maybe 1,500 cars using Manchester and Rock Stream. Let's say if it's half of what East Pass is, that's what we'd anticipate. I think that would be a nice connection because that signalized that McKee and Manchester, that people may use that. So, you know, in the spacing, you know, between McKee, it's decently far. So, that will be a busier intersection.
Just thinking in the future, you know, if you have the Rock Stream coming up there, is that the main drop-off point? Is that the main traffic to get kids in and out of Chavez right now?
Rock Stream?
Yes, because it's their main driveway now.
Okay, but
they're reevaluating that with they hired a consultant to reevaluate. So it's all, I mean, it's all up in the air, I guess, what they're going to do after this.
I guess what I'm getting at is, do you anticipate enough of a volume at that Manchester and Maple Grove that it's going to require an evaluation a few years once it gets done as far as traffic signaling? Is there enough volume coming through on Manchester that's going to be an issue?
Yeah, that could be possible. So we are actually going to be putting conduit under Manchester and putting handholds. So if it would make it easier if we did that in the future. Right now, it's not even close to warranting a signal, but you know it would make it more flexible in the future.
Okay, thanks.
Any other comments? Okay, thank you very much. Next, we have the crossover report from the Transportation Policy and Planning Board.
A lot of it already came up tonight. TPBB approved an ordinance to prohibit robot vehicles on sidewalks within the city, with an exception for campus. Thank you. And then we spent a lot of time talking about BRT routing. Do you want to say anything about that?
basically is going to be back in front of TPPB again at our next meeting, and then there will be a sort of formal resolution that will make its rounds on that.
So we look mainly at west routing and downtown routing because the city is trying to move forward quickly with the recommended alternatives for the Small Starts grant.
So, and I think it's something important to call out there is it's sort of a chicken and egg scenario, and I think everybody understands this, and we're all sort of just kind of trying to manage with it. But there's, on the one hand, applying for the Small Starts grant, we need to have a locally preferred alternative for the BRT route in order to do that work. On the other hand, we're just getting ready to put an RFP out for a network analysis that we are open to potentially significant changes in our local system and even potentially the proposed BRT route. So I think we acknowledge that sort of those dual paths. So I think we're just focused on what is the BRT route that we're going to use for this application process and to get going. But it shouldn't preclude us from really taking advantage of that that more robust study and going with whatever those recommendations are when they come out.
Thanks. Any comments or questions from the group? Okay. Next, just a reminder, Patrick. Was polling the group with regard to dates for a joint TCTPBB meeting. We're looking at either April 20th, which is a policy board established meeting date, or the 29th, which is one of our commission meeting dates. So that's our goal, and more to follow on that. Since Carl passed away, he was the representative from the Transportation Commission and the Dane County Specialized Transportation Commission. So we need, I need to appoint somebody from the commission to serve on the Dane County Specialized Transportation Commission. We are missing two people on our commission right now. So I don't know that I have a great sense of urgency in needing to make that appointment, but if anybody's interested, please send me an email, and I need to find somebody to fill that appointment. They normally meet 11 times a year. I think the schedule was out in Legistar, but I'm told that they don't actually typically meet all 11 times. So just keep that in mind if you're thinking about it.
What does the commission do?
Well, I looked online to figure out more about that. They look at moving the disabled, as I understand it, and it's countywide as opposed to just the city, so it's more regionally based. I couldn't find a good site where it very succinctly said this is the purpose of it. Yang, do you have any additional feedback?
No, that's my understanding as well.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's a paratransit kind of.
That's what thing. I suspected.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Right. Okay, anybody has any other questions on that? Tentative agenda items for the next meeting that was published out in Legistar. There was an additional item added, which Patrick sent out, and Grant just told me this evening that a new sidewalk assessment district is likely going to be coming onto that agenda as well. So Grant will get us more, or somebody will get us more information on that. Anybody have any other future agenda items that we don't already have on our agenda? Has this been working out well for people to be able to see this printed out? So, you know, I mean, I do it for myself, but just sharing it with people, hopefully that's helpful. Okay, good. We'll keep on trying to do that. All right. We need a motion to adjourn.
So moved.
Motion. Is there a second? All right. All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Aye. Motion carried. Thanks, everybody.